أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. قل اللهم مالك الملك تؤتي الملك من تشاء وتنزع الملك ممن تشاء وتعز من تشاء وتذل من تشاء بيدك الخير إنك على كل شيء قدير. تولج الليل في النهار وتولج النهار في الليل وتخرج الحي من الميت وتخرج الميت من الحي وترزق من تشاء بغير حساب. لا يتخذ المؤمنون الكافرين أولياء من دون المؤمنين ومن يفعل ذلك فليس من الله في شيء إلا أن تتقوا منهم تقاة ويحذركم الله نفسه وإلى الله المصير. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير. Say, O Allah, Lord of sovereignty, Thou givest sovereignty to whomsoever Thou pleasest, and Thou takest away sovereignty from whomsoever Thou pleasest. Thou exaltest whomsoever Thou pleasest, and Thou abasest whomsoever Thou pleasest. In Thy hand is all good. Thou surely hast power to do all things. Thou makest the night pass into the day, and makest the day pass into the night. And Thou bringest forth the living from the dead, and bringest forth the dead from the living. And Thou givest to whomsoever Thou pleasest, without measure. Let not the believers take disbelievers for friends in preference to believers, and whoever does that has no connection with Allah, except that you guard yourselves fully against them, and Allah cautions you against His punishment, and to Allah is the returning. Say, whether you hide what is in your breasts or reveal it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power to do all things. During the last session, we were discussing the verses 27th, 28th of Ali Imran, and I promised that if some points were left by omission, I will take them up again during the coming session. So I was telling you about the various opinions regarding the omission of the word shar from the verse 27. That is to say that many commentators have noted the absence of the word evil in the part of the verse which says, Thou pleasest and Thou abasest whomsoever Thou pleasest, in Thy hand is all good. While the commentators expected that Allah should also have mentioned that in Thy hand is all good and in Thy hand is all evil as well. So they say Allah only mentions in Thy hand is all good and omits the word evil, which does not mean that evil is not in the control of Allah, but it only means that evil is understood and it should have been mentioned, so it should be read as such. But I disagree with that, and I told you why. Now I have to point out that there is a definite reason why in this particular context the word evil has been left out. You know, the verse deals with the subject of God's power over all things. He is the master and sovereign of everything. He possesses everything. He has right of possession to everything He Himself has created. And as such, He takes away sovereignty from whomsoever He pleases and gives sovereignty to whomsoever He pleases and turns night into day and day into night. Now, why the earlier commentators wondered about the absence of the word shirk was that two processes were mentioned in the preceding verse. Good and evil, bestowing somebody with sovereignty, someone with sovereignty, and taking away some sovereignty from someone, turning night into day, and turning the day into the night. So the second part was understood to be by them as something evil, something wrong. So because God does that as well, they thought the Holy Quran should have mentioned after the word khair, that is good, evil as well, that He possesses power over khair, goodness, as well as evil. But that has been omitted for this very purpose, that Allah wants to make it clear that apparently what looks evil to you is not evil. There is always an underlying sense of goodness about it. When apparently night enters into day, some people may think that it is an evil process to replace light with darkness. But if you observe nature, from that you can derive the conclusion that passing of the day into night is a blessing in disguise. Not very much in disguise either. It's a very much apparent blessing too, to those people who are knowledgeable. If there were a constant day, you can imagine what the state of affairs would be here on the face of earth, like it is on the moon. A constant day on one side of the moon means that part of the moon is uninhabitable. It is totally deserted. And there is a constant night as well on the other face of the moon. So because of the total absence of light, that part is also uninhabitable. So here on earth, changing of night into day and day into night as a whole is an act of goodness. It should not be, even if you take it in parts and ponder deeper over this issue, you will realize that it's very important. And this is exactly what the Holy Quran itself has mentioned elsewhere. The Holy Quran says that what if God had made the day permanent for you? Where shall you seek shelter? Will you find shadow and coolness? And how will you able to inhabit this earth if this happened? And also the vice versa is mentioned by the Holy Quran there. So when the Holy Quran speaks positively on this very issue as an illustration of Allah's mercy and consummate wisdom, why should we attribute wrong meanings to this verse and start expecting the mention of evil as if the phenomenon discussed also has an element of evil about it? إِنَّكَ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ. That again is a verse which speaks of God's power over everything, not just the power of somebody who has usurped power, but the word قَدِير in itself, in Arabic, has a meaning of balance and something which is well measured and well calculated. So when you say Inna Allaha ala kulli shayin qadeer, immediately after this, it means that Allah wants to point out to us that all these things are well measured and well balanced, and nobody can change them for the good. One can only change them for the worse. Because if anything is well balanced, you can't tip the balance on one side without expecting some loss or some damage. So the word Qadir also indicates that the whole phenomenon is discussing goodness and there is no element of evil about it. The second verse, Tuliju al-layla fi an-nahari wa tuliju an-nahara fi al-layl, is in the same context. Already I have spoken about it. But there is one word which needs a little further elucidation, and that is the word mayyit, that is the dead. Thou bringest forth the living from the dead and the dead from the living. Here the dead does not only mean physically dead, but the word dead in this context has been used, and in other contexts as well, has been used in the Holy Quran to cover a wide meaning. Metaphorically, it is also applied, and in the Holy Quran it is used expressly for that. And also the word applies to a state of slumber. The mayyit is described in the Holy Quran as well as elsewhere to be a state of sleeping. So this is why the Holy Prophet of Islam taught us this prayer, that whenever you wake up, you pray to God, that, O God, you have brought us forth from the dead. And the same word mayyit is used to indicate that it should not be limited, it should not be applied in a limited sense only. The whole phenomenon which resembles death may also be living partially. Death, total death, is the physical death we know. But there are, if you divide the things in the world, partly they are similar to the phenomenon of life, partly they are similar to the phenomenon of death. And on two extremes, you can put the live in every sense and the dead in the every sense. So this is a process, gradual process of transfer of one state of affairs into another state of affairs. Like darkness does not give way to light immediately. There is dusk between or dawn between. So gradually it so appears. Now here it indicates that people spiritually do not die a sudden death. They gradually do things which gradually ushers them into death. And they are given enough warning. They are given enough signs. So if they want to avert that death, they have every possibility, every chance to at least struggle against death. So you derive your lessons from the phenomenon of light and day, and day and night, how they give way to each other, and then understand that similarly in the spiritual world, individuals as well as peoples don't suddenly get declared dead or alive. Even to gain life requires effort on your part and perseverance, and gradually things begin to change. And once you begin to lose that life, spiritual life, then you can make yourself aware through signs and symptoms if you follow them. And this is why the warnings from Allah come. They warn the people who follow the wrong, follow the evil ways and evil path. And in time they are told to retreat their step. Otherwise, until they will reach a state which is the point of no return. Now here, in the light of what we have said, the following verse would begin to will appear absolutely in context with what is being said. Otherwise, one might have thought that this verse is out of place, as if this subject which is discussed in the following verse had nothing to do with the earlier verse. So now, in the light of what I have said, I repeat the translation of the second verse which follows. That is said 29th. Let not the believers take disbelievers for friends, in preference to believers. And whoever does that has no connection with Allah. The fact is, this verse has been misquoted and misinterpreted, most unfortunately, not only by the elements hostile to Islam, but also by the Muslim scholars themselves. The subject of this verse has been so distorted out of shape that this verse is made an object of attack by the Muslims themselves, so that the enemies of Islam would strike at it and glut at this attack on Islam and have a perverted pleasure. But now, before I explain that, let me first establish the connection between the previous verse and this verse. When God has shown light and guided the people to the right path, and the intermix with those who have rejected that message freely and intimately, without guarding against their influences, it always happens that gradually they are overpowered, and those evil ways of life which they had left behind begin to creep upon them. There is no permanence in spiritual life or on spiritual state either. It is impossible for someone to feel permanently safe. As God has raised some people from the dead, into the spiritually living, after that they have no occasion to feel so safe as to obviate the possibility of their returning to their old evil ways. If they are unmindful of this, if they are unwary of this, and without guarding themselves against the corrupt habits of those who have rejected the message, and mix with them freely, the result would be that gradually they would start returning to the same ways and the same old evil habits. Now, if you study the history of rise and fall of religions, not of the empires, you will see the same phenomenon responsible for destroying the values of each religion after the passage of time. And the most important factor responsible for this is that after a while they begin intermixing with the older people and adopting their ways, not paying attention to what they were warned against, and gradually they mix with each other, so that after a passage of a few centuries, it is impossible to distinguish between their habits, their goodness and evil. Now look at the history of Christianity, for instance. In that reference, perhaps some of our guests would be better able to understand this. When Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, ushered a new era of light and revolutionary ways which rejected the previous corrupt practices of the Jews of his time, which laid overemphasis on revenge and hard-heartedness, and many such evil habits had crept into them. After a long time after Moses, peace be upon him, then you can find a very distinct difference between the society created by Jesus Christ and the society from which they had emerged. And after they had been well trained by Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, for a long time to come, you could see that they were two different people altogether. Their habits, their ways of life, their attitude to life, and their reactions to enemies, etc., were so distinctly apart that anyone could tell a Christian from a Jew. But after a while, after some centuries, they fell back into the same old habits or the same old ways which they had been told to reject. In the name of, say, humanity or social systems, they started intermixing with each other, with the result that today, if you want to find a distinct, separating line between the Jew and the Christian in the modern civilization, it will be very difficult to establish one sharp marking line that on this side stand the Jews in the Western civilization and on that side stand the Christians in their reactions to the enemies, for instance, in war and in peace. Almost entirely, they are now as one people under the sway of a so-called civilization, which is civilization of the West, the Western civilization. And they represent the Western civilization alike. It is impossible for you to discriminate between a Jewish reaction to the enemy and a Christian reaction to the enemy as far as the political reactions and social reactions are concerned. Individually, you may sometimes be able to differentiate between one good Christian and one not bad Jew, but good Jew, who sticks to his ways. He has also deviated from the old corrupt habits and started traveling towards some measure of Christianity. So he is not any longer exactly the Jew of the time of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him. So there you find a new dusk appearing, where the light of the day intermingles with the darkness, and then both of them together are ushered into a long night of almost total darkness. So this is how the light of Allah, which He has revealed, begins to fade away, and after a while there is no discrimination between various peoples. Once I was asked this question by a father of the church, I don't remember his designation, but he was a Christian scholar in Norway. He said, how would you look upon the state of various religions as far as their adherence is concerned, and are you in a position to declare that these people are hellish and those people are heavenly? So I said, when everything has gone again into the melting pot, it's impossible for anyone to pass such a judgment. Number one, it is only for God to know who is hellish and who is heavenly. The verdict is only to be passed by God and by God alone. But as far as the ways are concerned, as far as the scanning of the horizon and reaching a general conclusion is concerned, I find no difference. On the contrary, I find sometimes that religious people who have become a history, who have been abandoned, and after them new religious people came to be born, and new faiths were revealed by God. So historically speaking, they should reveal evil habits much more than those who are fresh in their contact with God. But if you scan the entire world population divided into various religious denominations, this is not what you find. Sometimes it is so difficult to differentiate between the qualities of one adherence of one religion from the adherence of the other, that, as I said, everything has gone back into the melting pot. This is a phenomenon which is being described and we are warned against. And this has been exactly predicted by the Holy Founder of Islam. Once he said that in the latter days, those who claim to follow me in their ways, in their habits, would become so closely similar to the Jews. He didn't say Christians, because perhaps at that time he found the Christian way of life slightly superior and better than the Jewish way of life. Slightly or more, but I mean, that is why, although they were the nearest to him in order of revelation, he did not mention them. He mentioned the Jews and said they, the people who would claim to follow me, would be so close in their way of life and habits and crimes to the Jews that as it is impossible to distinguish between one shoe from the other. Now, when I say that, I'll explain why. In the Oriental style of shoes, there is no right foot or left foot. Both the shoes are made alike. So it is not possible for anybody except the one who wears the shoe and whose feet are not blind. The rest of the people, by observation, cannot tell right from the from the left. So that is what he used. The illustration he used. And this illustration also is very interesting in the sense that the shoes are the worst part of one's dress. The part which touches the filth much, much more often than anything else. So to find resemblance and to express resemblance in the form of shoes is so apt here, because this is what he wants to find out. You will be similar to them not in good habits, not in the headdress, but in the similarity of shoes, in the filthy habits you have acquired and you will acquire. So when he says that a time would come when there would be no difference in the conduct of, between the conduct of a Muslim and the conduct of a Jew, how can we, as Muslims, declare that without any differentiation based on good conduct, Muslims are better and the non-Muslims are bad? So exactly the opposite is being said here to what is ascribed to this verse, unfortunately. This is the point which is being made by the Holy Quran. And the following part makes it further clear by pointing out وَمَنْ يَفْعَلْ ذَلِكَ فَلَيْسَ مِنَ اللَّهِ فِي شَيْنٍ. If somebody does that, it doesn't say, then he will be harmed or destroyed here directly. It says, then he will lose his contact with God. That is to say, he will lose godly habits. He would lose godly conduct. God turned him from evil behavior into a godly behavior. If you intermix with other people whom you have left in a manner that you begin to acquire their evil habits, then the natural result would be that you would be severing your ties with God, because He loves goodness and not evil. So that is what is being mentioned. And then immediately after it says, إِلَّا أَن تَتَّقُوا مِنْهُمْ تُقَاتْ. What is forbidden is not friendliness. What is forbidden is not a social contact at all. What is forbidden is to fall under the influence and bad influence of that society. تَتَّقُوا مِنْهُمْ تُقَاتْ means, except that you keep guard over receiving influences from them. Unless you are wary of saving your way of life and not being unduly influenced by that society. That permitted, Allah does not forbid you from having social contacts and gaining friendship of the non-believers. Now, if I am right, as is the accepted principle, then I must have some other verses of the Holy Quran supporting this view and this interpretation. And I have got exactly that. You know, it is an accepted principle of the Muslim scholars all over the world, without variation, that if we attribute some meaning to a verse of the Holy Quran, because the Holy Quran itself claims that part of the Holy Quran supports and clarifies the meaning of the other part, so we must be able to produce its counterpart, or its complementary statement, which should give authority to the person who interprets that his interpretation is correct and according to the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran in Surah Al-Mumtahina, chapter Mumtahina, verse 9, declares, لَا يَنْحَاكُمُ اللَّهُ عَنِ الَّذِينَ لَمْ يُقَاتِلُوكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ وَلَمْ يُخْرِجُوكُمْ مِنْ دِيَارِكُمْ أَنْ تَبَرُّوهُمْ وَتُقْسِطُوا إِلَيْهِمْ إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ الْمُقْسِطِينَ إِنَّمَا يَنْهَاكُمُ اللَّهُ عَنِ الَّذِينَ قَاتَلُوكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ وَأَخْرَجُوكُمْ مِنْ دِيَارِكُمْ وَظَاهَرُوا عَلَى إِخْرَاجِكُمْ أَنْ تَوَلَّوْهُمْ وَمَنْ يَتَوَلَّهُمْ فَأُولَئِكَ هُمُ الظَّالِمُونَ. Allah forbids you not respecting those who have not fought against you on account of your religion. Now, this verse, although it has been translated in this manner, has a wider application than just this. Yanhaakum anillazina lam yuqatilukum fiddin also means who oppose your faith, not necessarily with the help of sword, who are hostile to your faith and your way of life. Because ad-din is a word which is of a very wide application, and all the Arabic dictionaries give the various meanings of this. Even communism is a deen. Any way of life is a deen. So it doesn't say who fight Islam. It says ad-din, that is to say, and qatala, the word qatala does not mean necessarily fighting with sword. It also means opposition, hostility, attempts to frustrate. So Allah only forbids you to be on intimate terms with those of the non-believers who persist in opposing your faith, who are bent upon changing your way of life, who are hostile to your message, and also who will not spare the use of force against you whenever they can so do. And who have not driven you out from your homes. Here, in the second meaning, as we find this verse having been revealed at a time when the Muslims had already been expelled from their homes and turned out of Mecca. So, the illustration is given here. Like those who have turned you out of your homes. Now, after that, if you become intimate with them, there is not only a danger of your being influenced by them wrongly, but also there is a danger that they may exploit this situation and use it against the body of the Muslims, whether it's a state or not, against the Muslims as such. Now, because at that time the enemy was at war with the Muslims whom they had expelled earlier from Mecca, and they were so hostile that they would even attack Medina 250 miles north of Mecca after expulsion of the Muslims. They were not satisfied with that. They wanted to destroy them even there, and they took pride in following them. Wherever they went, this was their mission, they must be destroyed. So it is reported that some of the Muslims at that time, who had gained earlier friendships with some of the non-believers at Mecca, continued their relationship, and some of them to have been detected having passed on certain messages to them, not out of enmity of Islam, but out of friendliness to them. And they innocently believed that by doing them it a good turn, it wouldn't harm the the Islamic cause in any sense. So they were discovered. These verses, such verses, which speak of discouraging intimate relationship
with the enemy also apply to that particular situation. It applies, generally speaking, as a their expression of a universal truth, as which I have already explained. But also they apply specifically to that state of war in which the Muslim world found itself, and it was very dangerous for the cause of the Muslims if out of friendliness some secrets were passed. And that particular event which I am referring to happened in a manner that the Holy Prophet of Islam, when he received the news of the attack of the enemy, prepared a small group of Muslims to fend themselves against the attack. Well, this is a long story. To cut it short, these friends of some non-believers warned them that save yourself, but don't pass it on to others, you know, that sort of thing. It always happens particularly in ladies. I don't know whether ladies of England behave like this, but ladies in our country do. They tell a secret to another friend and tell them, look here, this is a very special secret. Because you are a special friend, I am telling you, but not to pass it on. And they stick to this advice and follow it to the extent that they use the same caution when they tell this the same secret to others. So this is how the secrets go out of hand, out of control. So that was what was happening there, to which this verse particularly referred. And again, there is another verse which speaks of a completely different thing as far as the friendliness is concerned. It says, "Asa an yajala bainakum wa bainal ladhina aadaytum minhum mawadda, wallahu qadir, wallahu ghafurur rahim." That when Allah tells you not to be over-friendly to your enemies, it is not an act of hostility on your part. It is not that Allah teaches you aggression. It's the other way around. What Allah says, that asa an yajala bainakum wa bainal ladhina aadaytum minhum mawadda. It may happen later on that Allah may cause the enmity which is being shown to you by your enemy to be turned into friendliness. That is to say, when that happens, then you are permitted to show friendliness to them. So this is a beautiful state of relationship as far as the Muslims are concerned, and there is absolutely no room for attacking Islam as teaching aggression and unfriendliness to the non-believers. It's exactly the other way around. What the Holy Quran is telling us is that despite the fact that the enemy had shown hostility and translated them into action of war, despite the Muslims were brought up in a manner that they wanted to show friendliness to them, as if they were itching to remain friendly. And God was telling them, not now. A time may come later, but not at this instance. It's too dangerous for you to become friendly with them, because they are your enemies and they have expressed their hostilities. So, not that Islam teaches aggression. Islam teaches cautiousness in a state of affair where others show aggression. And as far as the Muslim temperament is concerned, according to the Holy Quran, their temperament is always inclined towards friendliness and not to enmity. So in view of this irrefutable evidence of the Holy Quran, when we read some commentaries on the same verse, by some Muslim scholars, one really wonders what happened to them, why they did it. I believe they did it because they belong to an age where political warfare had started between Muslim states and some non-Muslim states. And there was no longer a fight of faiths, but there was a war of politics, of conquest. A territorial war was being fought. And unfortunately, the Muslim scholars were not able to distinguish as sometimes, even today, they are not able to distinguish between Islam and the Muslim world. It is similar to a state where many Christian states, I should say all the Christian states today, who are Christian because they are overwhelmingly Christian in population. When they go into war with each other, they don't practice Christianity in the strict sense taking. They don't offer the rest of the country to the enemy if the country grabs only a portion of their country. They fight back inch for inch, foot for foot. So, this is not literally speaking Christianity. And if somebody says that this is Christianity, it is wrong. If they show aggression beyond all justice, if they grab other people's places, if they become colonizers, if they exploit the poor and the defenseless, absolutely there is no justice whatsoever in declaring it to be a Christian way of life and a Christian expression. That will be cruelty to Christianity. So, unfortunately, that cruelty is being done without let or hindrance, not only by the non-Muslims, but the Muslims themselves to Islam itself, by confusing a Muslim state's conduct with Islam. And this is what has been responsible for creating so much, bad blood between the Muslim states and the non-Muslim world of today, and creating totally erroneous and corrupt impression about Islam. Because when you look at Khomeini, Imam Khomeini, this is a popular habit of attributing his conduct to Islam. And the Western press does not hesitate at all to call it Islam, militant Islam. These are the names given, books written on this subject. And on television programs, on radio propaganda, wherever you meet such things, the terrorism is Islam. If it emerges from Libya or some other place, Palestine, that is Islam. But when Palestinian state of Israel, perpetrates extreme acts of cruelty against some defenseless people living in camps while they are dying of hunger already, they bombard them on top of this, you won't find a single word of protest against Judaism. Never. Neither on television nor in the press. So this is the greatest wrong which has been done to Islam for centuries. But what can one complain against the enemies, who are enemies of course, when the Muslim scholars themselves have followed this stray and offered opportunity to the Western scholars to attack Islam on this head. I'll quote a few examples from the Muslim scholars' thinking on this subject. Not all of them, of course, agree with each other. This verdict is not unanimous, but overwhelmingly, this is the state of affairs. Ibn Abbas has taken the same view. Ibn Abbas is the companion of the Holy Prophet, about whom he prayed that Allah should show him the hidden meaning of the Holy Quran. He has taken exactly the position which I have already mentioned, that this verse only means that the Muslims should guard against evil values and guard themselves against the evil values, so that they are not unduly influenced by their corrupt practices. So, as far as their kindness, expression of kindness and friendliness is concerned, according to Ibn Abbas, that is not what is forbidden. What is forbidden is that in faith they should remain adamant and not to be unduly influenced. Thank you. Now, this is, as I said, this verse has been completely distorted by certain older scholars, and they attribute the permission of taqiyya to this verse. Taqiyya is a Shia term, which means that to tell lies is permitted in Islam for certain reasons. And the reason is the general good of your people. If you think that it is in the general interest of the Muslim body to tell lies and to defraud and mislead others, then it is permitted, and this is a regular term in Shia jurisprudence, which is called taqiyya. So here many a non-Muslim, non-Shia scholars have also taken the same stance, and for instance, one of the most prominent scholars, who is generally very, very good in his commentary, that is Imam Razi, he has taken this position. He says, okay, according to this, if a man is living among the disbelievers and he has fear about his life or his wealth, so it is permissible here, according to this verse, for him to tell lies to the others, to his opponents, to the extent that he should not let them, he should not reveal his faith within, keep them duped about his internal faith, and live among them as if he belongs to them, so that no harm comes his way. That is one form of taqiyya, and to this extent many Muslim scholars other than him have also agreed with him that this verse refers to that. But the Shias carry the taqiyya beyond this, much beyond this. And they believe that in everyday life, according under the license given to Muslims by this verse, in everyday life, for just ordinary things, if I tell a lie and hide the truth to gain some benefit, some profit, it is not cognizable in Islam. So that is why the lies were given free lessons for many centuries in some Muslim societies, damaging most deeply the Islamic values. While in the other places of the Holy Quran positively condemns roundly and completely falsehood in such terms that it is impossible for anyone, having read those verses, to attribute such meanings to any other verse of the Holy Quran, which stands totally in contradiction to that those declarations. In one place, the Holy Quran says that to tell lie is Satanism in essence. And nowhere does Islam permit speaking of lies. The Holy Prophet of Islam faced most difficult situations in the early period when the Muslims were the weakest all along their history. They have never been so weak as in the Meccan days, that is the 13 years after he declared to be prophet, and his followers were so mercilessly beaten and tortured and killed sometimes torn apart, the ladies, and sometimes they were beaten, they were made to stand in the hot sun of Arabia, where the temperature rose to 140 degrees, wearing thick armors and iron armors for that matter. And they were told to at least say that God is not one. And then they will be saved their lives, they spared their lives. And they preferred dying in that state rather than tell that lie. Where was the Holy Prophet of Islam not to tell them that it is permissible in Islam, go ahead and do it. So, to attribute this meaning to this verse is sheer cruelty to Islamic values. For 13 long years, it so happened, and on the authority of all the traditions, I can state that not in a single instance the Holy Prophet of Islam gave permission to any Muslim to hide his faith to save his life. Despite the fact, now I come to that part which is considered as taqiyya and which is related to this verse by these scholars. Despite the fact that in another verse, the Holy Quran says that if somebody is so weak and the amount of torture is so overwhelming that it is not in his power to resist this any further, and if he says from his mouth something in which he doesn't believe, then Allah will not punish him. That is not for the sake of deceiving others, nowhere. I mean, it's completely a different situation altogether. Keeping in view that all human beings are not at the same level of withstanding hardship. There are weak among us, there are cowardly people among us who are genuinely Muslims or belong to any particular faith, whatever it be, who are sometimes made to face such overwhelming hardships and torture at the hand of the enemy, politically as well as religiously, that it's impossible for them. They are not made to withstand that amount of pressure. So God gives them this word of relief, that don't go on tormenting the whole of the remaining life for the fear of torture and of hell and punishment of Allah. God is understanding. He does not expect things from you which are beyond your capacity. And this meaning is given further support by another verse of the Holy Quran, which says, La yukallifullahu nafsan illa wus'aha, laha ma kasabat wa alayha ma iktasabat. God does not coerce people beyond their capacity. That is to say, does not expect things from anybody which are beyond his capacity. As far as the preferences and the general rule is concerned, that is different, completely different from this. According to another verse of the Holy Quran, Allah has given the illustration of two women, well known in the history of Judaism and Christianity, and said that Allah expects the believers to be like these two women. And who are those women? Number one, Asiya, that is the wife of Pharaoh, who believed in Moses, and despite the fact that she was under extreme pressure of a mighty and cruel king, she guarded her faith and never renounced her faith in Jesus, in Moses. And that was her extent. Beyond that, she couldn't rise. The other lady, about which the Holy Quran says Allah expects you to be either like her or like the other one, is Mary. Now, what is the quality of Mary? She guarded her, what's it called, in virtue, and she was never touched by any base sentiment. Despite that fact, she was given power, special power by Allah, to give birth to a holy son. Now, this is a very interesting similarity which is expected by God between a believer and Mary. Everyone among us wants to rise and attain higher status with God. If we are in any way influenced by our ambitions and ulterior motives and want to give birth to a new personality within us, which is Jesus, which is a pure personality, then Allah condemns that and says that is not what is expected of you. You should remain pious to a degree, at least as Mary was. She was not influenced by any base sentiments or motivation, which ultimately resulted in her giving birth to a pure child. she abstained from all such things. It was just a gift of Allah to her, in which her own desire did not play any part. So similarly, those believers who want to rise to higher status and give birth to a new spiritual figure from within them, they are likened unto Mary, and they are expected to follow her course, her way of life. So that is to say, Allah, this is what is the expectation of God from believers. Nowhere it is said that you should start telling lie if you are under oppression of somebody else. So that is the external expression for which the symbol is mentioned of Asya, the wife of Pharaoh. And that is the extreme oppression of which you can think, of which you can conceive. And Asya, in relation to Pharaoh, was so defenseless. He was not a man either. He was a woman. And in being the wife of that despot, she was completely defenseless. So if Allah wanted the believers, even in such a state, to tell lies about their faith, Allah should have said it here in so many words. So whatever is attributed to these verses, in contradiction to very clear statements of the Holy Quran elsewhere, is not valid, is not Islamic. But as I told you, a great opportunity is provided to the non-Muslim scholars, and they have not lost that opportunity to avail. For instance, I think it is Wary, Mr. Reverend Wary again, who has taken special note of this situation. I brought an excerpt from his criticism on this head, but I can't find it anywhere. I must have misplaced it. I'm sorry. Perhaps it is, here it is. No. Oh, it's a pity. You know, I sometimes put, while consulting my papers, I put them in disorder. Ah, here it is, fortunately. Unfortunately, I attached it to a different verse with which, where it did not belong. No. This is a different comment. Go on. What has happened to my? Anyway, from memory, I'll speak of this. I'll explain what he has said in essence, though not verbatim. Mr. Wary has pointed out, basing on the comment. Oh, here he is now. Yes. According to his footnote on this verse, unless you fear any danger from them, there shall be no friendship between Muslims and non-believers, unless fear of the enmity of the infidels should make it necessary. Here we find a divine sanction to that duplicity so prevalent among Muslims. You see how testy and acid is the remark, but unfortunately this opportunity is provided by the Muslim scholars themselves. He says, here we find divine sanction to the Muslim character of duplicity which we so often find among them. Again, he goes on, taken in connection with the preceding context, this passage would seem to sanction apparent estrangement from Islam, provided expediency should demand it, under such circumstances, a Muslim may appear to be more friendly towards the unbelievers than he is towards his co-religionists. But this is just common. I mean, not perhaps it's not only Wary who has done it. Many other scholars have pointed out, they have not missed this opportunity. And they have further gone to explain that Islam positively teaches telling of lies and duplicity. Now again, most unfortunately, Maulana Maududi, among the modern scholars, even in this age of light, has taken the same stance. And because he is held in high respect in many parts of Pakistan as well as Saudi Arabia and some other countries, so it is very essential to reject his views on this and make it known to the people that this is his own distorted thinking. It has nothing to do with the Holy Quran. He doesn't say that if somebody is tortured to a degree that it is no longer within his power to withstand that torture, this is one particular state. He says, even if he fears torture or enmity or any sort of hostility, it is permissible to him to hide his faith and treat the non-believers as if he belonged to them. You know, that is his interpretation of this verse. Again, he turns to his own jamaat, that is Maududi, which is called Islami jamaat, and says, agar kuffar ke saath badarjaye majboori takhiya karna pade, to bas is had tak ke Islam ke mission aur Islami jamaat ke mufaad aur kisi musliman ki jaan o maal ko nuksan pahunchaye baghair apni jaan o maal ka tahaffuz kar lo. Now this has become a regular practice with the Maududis now, and we have witnessed this so often in their treatment of us. They spread lies about Ahmadiyyat while they stand in no fear from us, and it's the other way around. In fact, they preach hatred and torture against us, and they threaten us with extermination and killing, and practically exhort masses and elitist masses, for that matter, to go on looting Ahmadiyya shops and burning their houses and destroying them and killing them. And this is what they think is the holy war. And they say that to spread falsehood about Ahmadiyya is not un-Islamic, because it serves the purpose of helping Islam. Because in the total context of what is good for Islam and what is bad for Islam, if you spread lies about an enemy of Islam, they consider as enemy, because it will do a lot of good to the Muslim world, they will entertain ill will towards such people who are declared to be to holding ill will towards them. So this is what they do to us, and they say this is permitted on the strength of the Holy Quran itself. If that is permitted, then there is no order left in religion at all, not to mention Islam. If any religion permits the free use of lies, or even conditional use of lies, to deceive others about their faith or anything else, then there is no order left, as I said, in the world of religion, and all such religions could have been revealed by anyone but God. It's impossible for truth to teach falsehood. But as I said, in that context, where God knows it is beyond the power of man, he can't do anything. When he says something, he doesn't mean it. And even if God tells him not to do it, he will not be able to do it. There are such states in tortures during the last World War. They were very, very faithful agents sometimes of the British and the other powers allied, who found themselves in such difficult states, and they had to tell sometimes lives to save the torture, not their lives. Now again, as on the authority of the tradition, it is said that this verse, لَا يَتَّخِذِ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ الْكَافِرِينَ أَوْلِيَاءَ, was revealed particularly regarding Abdullah bin Ubay bin Sulul. He was a person who was charged with hatred, not only against Islam, but against the founder of Islam, and he left no opportunity unutilized to debase him and publicly condemn him, while he himself was so weak that any time the Holy Prophet of Islam wanted him to be wiped out and destroyed and demolished, his own son was ready to do that, who had become a Muslim and a faithful Muslim for that matter. Once, while they were returning from a battle, he insulted the Holy Prophet of Islam in such a manner that it was no longer tolerable for any Muslim. And some people approached the Holy Prophet of Islam to give them permission to kill him. When his son heard of this, what his father had expressed about the words he had used against the Holy Prophet of Islam, he approached him himself and said that he does not deserve to live anymore. He has crossed all limits. But if you permit someone else to kill him, then I may nourish some grudge against him later on and say that he killed my father, and thereby I'll destroy my faith, because he will not be doing it for his own sake, he will be doing it for a just cause when he is permitted to do that. So if you ever consider that possibility, then tell me to kill my father. That was the extent of his faith, and it was also, apparently, it seems to be impossible for his son to seek permission to kill, but the way he'd explained, that was quite understandable. So this was the man in particular about which the tradition tells us that he and his followers were mentioned in this verse. Some people, despite that express and explicit hostility made by them towards Islam and the founder of Islam, were friendly to him and his party. And this God did not like, and said, if you remain friendly and to such people, then you are bound to be influenced by them, then there is absolutely no connection between you and God. If somebody is insulting your father, you can't tolerate it, you can't be friendly with the enemies of your father and mother. How can you remain friendly with someone who is insulting your spiritual father and so on? So that is the spirit conveyed in this. And according to those who have quoted this tradition, this situation has nothing to do with lies or truth, nothing. I mean, that's completely out of context to this. Now, I think we have no time to proceed to the second verse, so I should better leave it here. Let me find out if there is any other thing of importance which I must tell you. Now about taqiyya, the various, this permission of tell lies of convenience or which suits one's cause, even the Shia imams are not unanimous. Some Shia imams have mentioned, and this is related about Imam Sadiq, that this is an order of God that every Muslim must practice taqiyya. And if somebody is not telling lies for the sake of some good purpose, then he is not a complete Muslim. You know, that is the extreme stance taken by him. On the contrary, Imam Baqir is said to have taken a completely different view. And he was also a Shia Imam. Was he the father of Imam Jafar Sadiq, Imam Baqir? Huh? Yes, I think it was Imam Baqir who was the father of Imam Jafar Sadiq. And they held son and father relationship. One or the other was father and son and so on. So the Imam Baqir has taken a very sensible position. He said taqiyya only means a compulsion to a degree where you become mustar. Mustar is a term of the Holy Quran applied to such extreme situations where it is the only choice for you is to do something or die. When you reach that stage, then you are even permitted to eat the flesh of swine. And the word mustar exactly is used there in that context by the Holy Quran. So Imam Baqir says that taqiyya is related to the state of being mustar. If you are tortured to a degree where the life is about, only at that juncture you are permitted to say something in which you don't believe, only to a degree that you save your life and not beyond. That is also a condition applied to the state of mustar, and on this every other scholar is agreed that where the word mustar is used in the Holy Quran with reference to eating of flesh of pig, this is the condition laid down by the Holy Quran itself. So Imam Baqir very wisely has related it to that state and explained the whole situation away. And this is Tafsir Safi, again a tafsir that is a commentary written by Shia scholars, and it is held in very high repute by the Shias. They can't poo-poo it away by telling that it's just a Sunni tradition which you are following. The scholar is a very renowned scholar of Shias, and the book is a very weighty book, so we must agree that even the Shia scholars are not agreed on this extreme position which is taken generally by the other Shias today. As far as the founder, as the second head of the Ahmadiyya community is concerned, the Caliph Khalifa before my predecessor, he has taken exactly the view which I have already expressed, and he further points out to support this position that immediately after Allah says, وَيُحَذِّرُكُمُ اللَّهُ نَفْسًا, that God warns you against danger from Him. So you should strike a balance. There is a danger you are facing from the enemy, but that is not the only danger. If you renounce Islam, remember that also you are going to meet God, and who is going to bring you to book. And you have to appear on the day of reckoning. So this, how could this part of the verse follow if God was permitting people to tell lies without any fear or without any consideration whatsoever? So here again, it is mentioned that this decision is going to be very critical and very delicately balanced. If you ultimately decide to say something which is not truth, keep in view that God is more powerful and He's stern in reckoning, much more stern in reckoning than any enemy on earth could be. So in view of that, even if keeping that in view you can't withstand the pressure anymore, then of course God can forgive you, but not before that. This very interesting argument was for the first time produced by the late second caliph of Ahmadiyya. And no other scholar ever thought of this very interesting way of interpreting this verse.